Transportation Committee to order. And the first thing on our agenda this morning is to welcome a new member to the committee, Senator Amy Coe. Welcome to Transportation. We served together for 4 years in room 15, and that was I learned a lot. We sat next to each other, and it was I'm glad to have you here with your experience. Thank you. Today's order of business will be MnDOT overview of the budget forecast. Welcome to the committee, and appreciate you being here. We'll also be talking about the contractor claims process, and also the DPS MnLARS system update. And thank you all for being here. And Mr. Peterson, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. It's a pleasure to be here with you again this afternoon. Our new CFO, I guess she's not totally new, but recently appointed CFO, Tracy Hatch, is going to walk through the numbers from the November forecast so everyone can get a good picture of where we're at with our transportation funds.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Hatch. Thank you for taking the time to put this together for us and to update us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're welcome. This, again, is the November forecast. We'll have a new forecast, as you're aware, coming out in February. We're working on that forecast right now, but currently this is our current forecast. Oops. As you know, we forecast six transportation funds at MnDOT: the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, which is made up of the gas tax, the registration tax, the motor vehicle sales tax. We also forecast the Trunk Highway Fund, which is the main funding source for most MnDOT projects, as well as the County State Aid Highway Fund, the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund, the State Airports Fund, and the Transit Assistance Fund. The forecast is always, as you know, an estimate of where we expect the end of the fiscal year balance in the fund to be. We typically update only November and February, but as you'll see, the Trunk Highway Fund was also updated at the end of session because there were changes in session law that affected that fund. For the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, also called the HUTD, again, there are three main sources of revenue for that fund: the gas tax, the registration tax, and the MVEST. MVEST is currently at 60% going into that fund, and the remaining 40% of the motor vehicle sales tax going to the Transit Assistance Fund, which I'll touch on here in just a few minutes. Of the funding that goes into the HUTD, 95% of the funding is allocated to the Trunk Highway Fund, the County State Aid Fund, and the Municipal State Aid Streets Fund. There's an additional 5% set aside, and that goes to fund 46% of that funds the Township Road and Bridge Program, and 53.5% goes into the Flexible Highway Account, which funds the turnbacks currently on the county system. There are modest changes to the HUTD overall. As you'll notice here, the red indicates the February forecast, so the forecast of just not quite a year ago, and the blue lines indicate the November forecast, and that is the same in all of the slides you'll see today. We actually are pretty proud of our forecast from last year. The actuals for 2011 came in about $12 million up from forecast, which is within 1%. So we felt pretty good about our forecast last year. Last February. We are also forecasting for the future 4 years, including 2012. We're forecasting the fund to be down slightly in 12 by $11 million, slightly down in 13 as well by $4 million, regaining again $4 million in 2014, and then $3 million in 2015. So overall, modest changes to the fund overall. For gas tax in particular, we're also calling that virtually flat. You'll see some distinctions here. Again, our actuals came in just slightly below where we had forecasted, but we're also forecasting that to be a similar trend for fiscal year 12. Overall, for 12 and 13, we're expecting the revenue from the gas tax to be down $0.2 million, so $200,000 or within 0.01%. In the out years, you'll see fiscal 14, we're expecting a slight increase of $3.9 million, and we're forecasting flat for 2015 compared to last forecast. Just as a reminder, the outlook for fuel consumption is affected by many things, such as the economy in general, world oil prices, long-term policies such as CAFE standards, consumer trends towards more fuel-efficient vehicles, and then the variety of additional transportation options available to consumers. This is a chart that we included to show you the history of the gas tax here in Minnesota. as well as current federal rates and the rates in neighboring states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, South Dakota, Iowa, and North Dakota. Currently, we are at a 28-cent per gallon rate. That includes 25 cents of a gas tax and 3 cents of a debt service surcharge that was passed in Chapter 152 in 2008. That law provided us with a 5-cent increase as well as 3.5 cents of a debt service surcharge, and that last half cent of the debt service surcharge will be in effect this July 1st. Moving on to registration taxes, these are also called tab fees. You'll see that our actuals came in for 2011 up just over $12 million from where we had forecast. We are forecasting them to be down over the period of fiscal year 12 and 13 by just under $10 million, or 0.9%. And again, looking out into 2014 and 15, we are expecting them to be down to $31.4 million, or about 2%, 2.6% reduction. Generally, that is due to lower forecasted car sales. The rate for consumers to purchase new cars and get their first registration in is lower than what we had previously expected. Chapter 2008 Chapter 152 revised the registration tax schedule, and that is still being phased in. The older vehicles are still in the fleet, which does affect the revenue we receive from the tab fees. For motor vehicle sales tax, again, our forecast is virtually flat. We are fully phased in at the 60% level for MVEST coming into this fund. Again, the other remaining 40% goes into the Transit Assistance Fund. For 2011, MVEST came in about $4 million up from where we expected. And for 2012 and 2013, we're expecting a slight decrease of $1.7 million, or 0.3%. Again, looking out into the planning years of 2014 and 2015, we're expecting an increase in revenue overall of $40.3 million, or 5.6%. This chart we included to show you the motor vehicle sales tax distribution, both from 2011 and then the final phase-in for 2012 and through 15, as well as the split by fund, so how much goes to the HUTD and the Transit Assistance Fund. Looking now at the Trunk Highway Fund, again, we are comparing this fund not to February of last year but to the end of session. 2013, we are forecasting the fund balance to be $203 million, which is up quite a bit from the end of session forecast. That is primarily due to debt service savings we received on a recent bond sale. We had expected our debt service to be $128 million for fiscal year 12. It actually came in at $72.6 million, and I'll explain why here in just a minute. But that generated a number of savings, obviously, for this fund. The $203 million projected balance, we will need $85 million of that to maintain compliance with our fund balance policy. And you'll also be seeing the governor's recommendation of a $17.5 million capital request come through to fund that with cash for some building projects we have. Our estimate for 2015 is a fund balance of $219 million. This is a chart that shows you, again, in kind of graphic format, the change in our debt service transfer projections. The red line indicates where we expected to have been in that we were projecting last February, and the blue line indicates where we're projecting currently. The difference you see there, for example, again, in 2012, we had expected the debt service on the Trunk Highway Fund to be $128 million, and it came in at $72.6 million. That was primarily because of decrease in interest rates. Interest rates have remained very low. It's also as a result of having a large premium on our last bond sale. When the interest rate is below 5%, we have a large premium in the first year. In other words, we have sort of a savings in the first year and pay more on the later years of the bonds. When it comes to the Federal Highway Trust Fund and our federal funding, that's very important to us. That is part of our Trunk Highway Fund forecast, and we pay very close attention to that. You may be aware that we are currently under an extension. We've had 8 extensions from the expiration of our last federal authorization, which was a bill called Safety Lou. The current extension expires March 31st of 2012. We also have an appropriation that goes through the end of this federal fiscal year, which ends September 30th. So we expect and we hope that there will be an extension of the authorization to go along with that appropriation, and we're watching that very closely. I just wanted a quick note that the current appropriation level, if it is extended, will cause the Highway Trust Fund to be insolvent at the end of this federal fiscal year, so September 30th. So again, we are watching that very closely and taking steps to manage through that. The County State Aid Highway Fund is down slightly compared to forecast for fiscal 12 and 13 by $4.4 million. You'll see interest income is also down $11.9 million for 12 and 13. Again, interest rates remain low right now, and that not only affects our ability, what we have to pay for our debt service, but that affects the interest that we get on our funds as well. There's an additional source of revenue for the County State Aid Highway Fund, and that is the motor vehicle lease sales tax. This was the first year that we've actually received motor vehicle lease sales tax. We were notified per law on June 30th that we would be receiving revenue from that source, which was previously forecast by the Department of Revenue to be zero. So we did take in some funding there. That funding that comes in is split between the County State Aid Highway Fund and the Greater Minnesota Transit. The Municipal State Aid Street Fund, similarly, is slightly down. The Commissioner's order for the Minnesota State Aid Street Fund is $146.8 million. It was on the previous slide, but I neglected to point it out. The Commissioner's order for the County State Aid Highway Fund is $473 million for calendar year 2012. And again, for the Municipal State Aid Street Fund, interest income is down as well. Looking at the State Airports Fund, the State Airports Fund, as a reminder, receives 4 different types of revenue: the airline flight property tax, aircraft registration tax, fuel taxes, and interest income. Overall revenues have decreased $0.9 million, or just 2.2% for 12 and 13 from our prior forecast, which was February of last year. Revenues are essentially flat for the out years of 14 and 15. And there on the slide listed for you is the fund balance for 2011 and 2013. And finally, our Transit Assistance Fund is currently receiving 40% of the MVEST that is sharing 60%, as I mentioned, with the HUTD. This funds Greater Minnesota Transit and the Met Council. Out of that 40% of MVEST that goes into the Transit Assistance Fund, 4% goes to Greater Minnesota Transit and 36% goes to Met Council. Or in other words, 90% of the receipts go to Met Council, 10% to Greater Minnesota Transit. The lease vehicle sales tax, again, as I mentioned a moment ago, was not expected. It was forecast at zero by the Department of Revenue, and we received word again on June 30th that we would be receiving funding from that. So the forecast is up for 12 and 13 by $9.7 million and up $6.9 million for the planning period of 14 and 15. For the Greater Minnesota Transit portion of the fund, the total funds are up $15.6 million in 12 and 13 and again $9.6 million in the planning period. Greater Minnesota Transit also receives general fund direct appropriation as well. Are there any questions?
Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair, going back to the slide on, the, I think, your third slide, is there any change in, or can you put on the percentages there of what percentage gas tax brings into the fund, registration tax brings into the fund, MVEST?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hatch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For fiscal year 12, we expect 50% of the total revenue to the HUTD to be from the motor fuel tax, 32% to be from the motor vehicle registration tax, and 18% to be from the motor vehicle sales tax.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Mr.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you. If I'm not wrong, that adds up to 100%, right? So how do we then account for the federal dollars that then go into the...
Is that true?
The federal funds are recorded in the Trunk Highway Fund and not in the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund.
Oh, I see. That. So yep. We go down there. Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Well, thank you for the update, and hopefully the outlook gets a little better for us and we get a little bit more money going in there to help us with our roads and bridges and some creative financing initiatives that MnDOT is working on will be helpful in that area, too. So very much appreciate the presentation and the update.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Hall?
Just one more follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is it, has this changed historically, the percentages there?
Is that?
Not significantly. That's generally, I think, the percentages that you'll find. We do update those numbers every forecast just to track, but typically that's pretty typical.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Hatch. Next part of our presentation today will be an update on the claims process. And Mr. Chigalow, appreciate you being here and updating us. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, again, if I may, Scott Peterson from MnDOT. While Mr. Chigalow is getting his presentation up, I just will do a little bit of introduction for him. Mr. Chigalow is the division director for the Engineering Services Division at MnDOT, which, among other offices, he's also responsible for the construction office, which administers our construction contracts. And so their office is primarily responsible for handling the claims issue.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Chigalow.
Mr. Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to present this to you today. The statewide suspension claims that occurred, obviously, last July impacted 165 projects. 117 of those projects have completed work as of the end of the construction season last summer, in the construction year of 2011. 36 of those projects have had work move from the 2011 construction season to the 2012 season or beyond. 12 of the projects did not start work in 2011 that were scheduled to start work in 2011 have been completely moved to 2012 and will start work in 2012. MnDOT contracts provide for a series of contractual entitlements, in essence, for addressing suspensions or claims from contractors. And under our standard contract specification 1402.2B, that allows us, as part of a federal requirement, through the federal regulations, we're required to use this specification in all of our contracts. That requirement allows us to suspend contracts, as we did last summer, without a breach of contract. It provides entitlement to the prime contractor to submit a claim associated with the suspension of work also. So the next series of slides are just an understanding of how these things are addressed within all of our contracts. MnDOT contracts also provide the opportunity for contractors to submit claims under our contract specification 1517. And there are other contract specifications that would apply in this case, but these are really the two main specifications that we're following as part of this claim process. This specification provides entitlement for the prime to submit claims for materials or work not covered in the contract, so work that they would deem out of scope or impacts that they've incurred because of us suspending the work.
What are some examples of that that type of a situation? If you don't mind, thank you, Mr.
And I think this next slide will help, Mr. Chair, this next slide will help explain that. There's really three phases of the suspension. There's a pre-suspension, during the suspension, and post-suspension impacts. The pre-suspension impacts fall under 1517. They may include us requiring the contractor to accelerate work to avoid an impact, to complete the work prior to the suspension occurring. They would require, would be including us requiring traffic control to be installed prior to the suspension taking place, preparing the site through erosion control measures to prepare the site as we are not, while we're not there, to for encountered rainstorms or what have you. Other things would be to prepare the site in terms of safety, different activities that we would require to get that project ready for a suspended time. During the contract, during the suspension, there would be, there would be 1402.2B would be the provision that we would be following. Again, this is the provision that allows us to suspend the work without a breach of contract. The things that would be covered would be idle equipment that would be sitting there without being used, extended field overhead, which would include the superintendent that might still be working to make sure the site is being kept up, the field office that remains there during the suspension, maintaining the traffic control, managing the site after a rainstorm, things such as that. Field equipment that may still remain there as well. Traffic control and erosion control would be a part of those activities that they were performing while we suspended work, just to maintain the site, make sure we remain in compliance with specifications or with our permits, and make sure that the site was not creating a safety hazard for the road users. Then there's post shutdown, which would fall under specification 1517. Again, there may be acceleration that we would direct the contractor to pursue to complete the work by the end of the season, where we felt it was in our advantage to do so, or the contractor felt there was an advantage to do so, so we worked together to negotiate some acceleration time in the schedule. Unabsorbed home office overhead would be another cost that could be incurred. This could also be incurred during the shutdown, a lot of the times, the majority of the work we feel would be incurred for unabsorbed home office overhead after the shutdown. This type of cost would include rent for the home office, utilities for the home office, things that are normally part of their bid that they've had to incur additional costs to maintain over a certain period of time because of the suspension. The cost of their estimators, the cost of their schedulers, someone that normally isn't billed directly to a project, but they have an overhead cost associated with them in their overall revenue that they're generating. Bond costs, insurance costs, etc. So those would be considered unabsorbed home office overhead. And then there would be material escalation costs. And these costs would be increased costs in fuel, especially the projects that are going to be completed this year or will be starting this year. There will be costs associated with those projects more than likely, not in all cases, but more than likely with material escalation, labor escalation potentially, material costs in terms of steel, asphalt, cement, fuel, and those such things would all be looked at as far as material escalation. I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Just ask a quick question here on the acceleration portion of the post efforts there, considering the good weather that we had that extended into November and the first part of December. Was that acceleration process helpful, and did we see a lot of these projects get back on track?
Mr. Chair, the good weather was definitely a mitigating factor for the overall impacts of this suspension work. There's no doubt about the fact that the mild fall that we had and the lack of rain accommodated us in many ways to complete work to a large extent. And I think that had a large impact on the 117 projects that we were able to complete last year. And I think that the activities and the projects that did move work into this year I think were large, for the most part, large scale. They were at a point where they couldn't get any more work done last fall, and whatever work was remaining had to be moved to this spring to start work again. So yes, the weather did have a big impact on mitigating the costs of the suspension.
And can you give us some sense or some idea of the types of awards that were given to contractors, the amount of a ballpark figure as far as the amount that contractors received through this acceleration process?
Through the acceleration process, I don't have that broken down, but we have settled 29 claims, Mr. Chair, for a total of, to date, a little over $2 million. It's important to note, Mr. Chair, that the focus on the number of claims I know has been asked. It's the number of projects, and when those projects complete is when we start getting a better picture of the overall impact of the suspension. And 52 of the projects have been settled for time extensions only, which is a very important aspect. Another 48 of the remaining 113 projects, so out of the 165, 52 have been settled for time extension only. That leaves 113 remaining. 48 of those remaining 113, and I'm throwing a lot of numbers around, but 48 of the 113 that remain have settled for time and reserved the right to cost claims at a later date. And a lot of times that's because they haven't incurred the costs to fully understand the impact. And so some of those projects obviously have been completed, so we're working out those issues and those details now. Some will continue to be worked out through this coming construction season as they fully understand the impacts, and we can resolve those hopefully beginning next fall. But it's important to note that multiple claims can be submitted for each project. Each subcontractor could submit their own individual claim, for instance, and resolve that individually. We would rather, for efficiency's sake, try to do that as one claim and deal with it as one claim. But each subcontractor has to work through their prime, because our contract, the state of Minnesota has a contract with the prime contractor. The prime contractor has a contract with the subcontractors. So we deal directly with the prime in these issues, and the contractor has to facilitate the subcontractor claims through them to us. And so each claim, each project will more than likely or could more than likely have more than one claim. So as I mentioned, 29 claims have been resolved for a cost to date of a little over $2 million. So that's not total projects, that's 29 claims. So there are a number of factors that we are working on currently, because this is a very complicated issue at times. The projects may not seem complicated, but working through some of the home office overhead, the unabsorbed home office overhead, the extended field overhead, the idle equipment can be complicated and take some time. So these are just factors that we are working through on a project-by-project basis, especially the first three. The home office overhead and False Claims Act are more of a programmatic approach to make sure that we are being consistent from project to project. We are taking more of a programmatic approach on both of those. The significant one that we do not have a lot of control over is the structural steel, fabrication of beams or girders or other elements that are provided by a supplier that supply steel not only to us but to many states or many projects or many entities. And it's not always easy once the suspension or the impact occurs to get back in the queue to move that project forward again. So there is a time. It's not a one-to-one trade-off in many times when it comes to the steel fabrication issue. It can be more than a factor of one, obviously, in an impact.
Can you tell us roughly how many projects we're exposed to that type of a situation where large beams had to be pushed back into the queue, and that's going to cause a delay?
I would say it's around a handful, 4 to 5, maybe 6 projects that have had that type of impact. But some of those are very large projects, and we're working through those issues now, and we're resolving things one step at a time. And it really takes a lot of effort to work with not only the prime but the supplier to mitigate those costs. And that's something that we're truly focused on, avoiding costs associated with this and minimizing the impact to the contractors. But as the state, we are also very interested in doing our due diligence and making sure that the costs that we're agreeing to pay are defendable and will stand up to scrutiny.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chigall, I had a quick question. You had mentioned that certain inspectors were still out in the field during the suspension. Where does the funding for those inspectors come from, even in a shutdown situation? And how much, how much was allocated to that during this last suspension?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would have to have Mrs. Hatch talk to some of the total costs, but the contractor had their people as part of the contract. They had responsibilities to maintain traffic control. They had responsibilities to maintain erosion control, and their superintendents in a lot of cases were the people that managed that. MnDOT did have a very small amount of people that were here that would go out on a random basis and verify that things were being maintained, but it was a very small amount of people, and I would have to defer the question on the total cost to Mrs. Hatch.
Thank you.
Senator Greif.
Thank you, Chairman Gimsey. I have a question happened to do, with the state shutdown. If we were going to have kept the construction companies rolling, what kind of a skeleton crew would we have had to have in place in order to accomplish that, to keep the contractors going?
Mr. Chigall.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think the number of people would be larger than what you might think. Mm-hmm. There would be inspectors. There would be field engineers. There would be more budgetary people to pay invoices. There would be people in our labs that do the testing. So there would be a large contingency of folks that would be out there managing that aspect. And during the shutdown, we did not have inspectors, obviously. We used some other people to manage some of that to a limited extent. But I don't have a number off the top of my head, Senator, but it would be a large contingency. I don't think it would be 100 people. It'd be probably more towards 1,000 people.
Senator Kreft.
Thank you. If I could have a follow-up. Mm-hmm. Would you give a little bit of thought and give me a report of what you see as who would have been necessary staff in order to keep the crews going?
Mr. Chair and Senator, yes, we can get you that information.
Thank you.
I just have a question, Mr. Chigall, on the use of contractors during the shutdown time to maintain the traffic control and the erosion control aspects during the shutdown. Was that in agreement with those contractors beforehand, and I see now, looking at this, that they're having to use a claims process in order to get paid for that work. Can you kind of clarify that for me?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that there are contract provisions that require the contractor to provide a safe work site and maintain compliance with permits during a shutdown. And the claims process is a process for them to recoup costs that they do not feel they've been that have been accounted or have been offered to them through our contractual process or requirements that are in place.
So they understood that up front, and that's a part of the contract?
They were, Mr. Chair, they were directed by us to perform those duties in accordance with the contract. I think the direction was clear. The way that costs would be compensated for doing that, I think through the fact that they're filing claims was not as clear as we would have liked it to have been.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this where I ask for my Highway 14 money?
It would be appropriate on the opening.
We'll save that for later. Bringing up a question, I just want to follow through on that. I think I talked to you, Mr. Chair, about the sign company that had to keep their signs up longer than what they were contracted for. I mean, does it become a very gray area? Who's responsible? I mean, if the sign company was to take their signs down because the project was over and there was no provisions, and then we go into the shutdown, and so they needed them, but they weren't told that they were going to get compensated for this. If they would have taken that, who would have been liable for any kind of accidents or something in a case like that? I'm trying to get a handle to see where, if in fact the state would say, no, you're going to leave those signs up even though we're not committed to pay you or it's not in the contract. So does this go through this claims process? But the other question is, had they just pulled up their signs at the end of their contract period?
Mr. Chickle?
Who would have been responsible?
Mr. Chair and Senator, is this a hypothetical? I'm sorry.
No,
I did. Is this a hypothetical or is this a actual project?
Did you ever, Mr. Chair, we talked about this. I've got it up on my desk. Matter of fact, maybe that's what I should do is just get in touch with you on this because I had a gentleman that had a contract with the state. Time was up. Shutdown came. Project wasn't completed, but yet his contract was up, as I understand it. And he couldn't take his signs down, which created a loss of money one place, and he doesn't know whether he's going to be compensated or not.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Trickle.
Senator, I'd be happy to sit down and talk to you about the project, and then I can get informed on the specific details of that project. But generally speaking, if the project was not complete, the prime contractor is responsible for maintaining the safety and the integrity of that site. And if the signs were required to maintain the integrity or safety of that site, the expectation would be and the contractual obligation would be that those signs remain in place.
Right.
And if there was some provision that in the contract that if the provision in the contract stated the signs only need to be in place for X many days, there would be days in addition that they could be compensated for. But like I said, I'd be more than willing to sit down and talk to you about the specific project.
Thank you.
Well, you do bring up an interesting point, though, Senator Perry, and that's the exposure. The total exposure, though, for, say, a sign that was down that inadvertently went down in a storm or something, the contractor didn't see it right away. An accident was caused by that or was a factor in an accident or something, who's exposed there?
Mr. Chair, those are circumstances that we encounter every day on our projects, and the contractors outside of a suspension or inside of a suspension are responsible in accordance with the contract because we did not terminate the contract. We suspended it. They're still under contract with us. They are responsible for maintaining the integrity of those signs, and there's provisions in the contract requiring them to patrol that site and identify those types of concerns and correct them within a certain amount of time. And so we manage the liability in that way, and I think those same provisions were in place during a suspension.
Did we have any incidents where we are dealing with that possibility in this?
Mr. Chair, there's, every day on our construction jobs, there's a sign that gets blown down by a semi that comes by, or there's barrels that are knocked down. You know, even though our people were laid off, it didn't stop them from calling those concerns into the contractor either. And so our people have a strong pride in what they do on a day-to-day basis, and their interest in the public safety was noticed at that point too. They as they drove through projects, they would notify the contractor or the appropriate people that there was an issue, and we would get it addressed. But the contractor was also doing that as well with their own forces in accordance with the contract.
Yeah, well, nobody is questioning the dedication of our MnDOT employees, and I'm sure they would call if they saw something.
Sure.
But my question was more directed toward the liability aspects of that than
sure, understood.
Getting a clarity on that. Senator Hall, did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I've got a couple questions. Senator Grzelka asked me to ask you this question, Mr. Gigolo. The estimates is that the shutdown cost the state $60 million, and we had a savings of $65 million. But his question is, was this number that you're talking about here, was that included in the numbers that the state gave, or is this on top of those numbers?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the number and the cost associated with our claims was not included in that number.
Okay. All right, that answers that question. And then for my own question, Mr. Chair, can you tell me when we saw this coming this direction, when the potential shutdown was coming, can you tell me what estimates were put together and who was briefed on this? You know, was the governor briefed on what the potential costs could be on this?
Mr. Chiglo?
Mr. Chair, there were a lot of conversations at that time. We were focusing on how we get our projects to a point where we're protecting the safety of the public, how we could get to a point where we're well-documented prior to the shutdown so that we could make sure we're capturing the costs that are incurred if this suspension was to occur. There was a lot of preparation. As far as the details that were given, I'm not aware. I was not part of any discussions with the governor, but that doesn't mean they weren't happening. I think we were preparing quite expansively in many different forums for this, for the shutdown and the suspension, and I'm not aware of the conversations that would have occurred with the governor.
Sir, I'll follow up.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe it would be a better question for the commissioner, but that's what I'd like to know is did you do any calculating at all on the potential costs on a per-day basis or anything?
Mr. Chiglo? Mr. Chair, yes. Senator, yes, we did. There was a dollar value that we computed. It was a range of costs depending on the length of the suspension. I think it was anywhere between $500,000 and $1 million a day, depending on the length of the suspension.
Any further questions?
Yeah, I'll follow up.
Senator Hall.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Driggle, do you think that this is going, that it's going to come out to about what you estimated it to be then?
Mr. Driggle.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as you can see, we've made a lot of good progress. There's still a lot of work to be done. As I mentioned, we've incurred about $2 million in costs in our projects. And at this point, it is too early, really, to say what the total estimated cost is. We're very focused on mitigating the cost to the greatest extent possible to avoid costs. And a lot of the costs in 48 projects have not been incurred yet, and some of those are our larger projects. So it's really too early to tell at this point what the total cost will be.
Thank you for the information.
If you'd like to proceed, otherwise, thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. I think that completes my presentation.
Other questions? Thank you, Mr. Chiglo. Next up, we have Tim Werke with the Associated General Contractors and Lori O'Malley with O'Malley Construction, also a member of Associated General Contractors. Mr. Werke, Ms. O'Malley, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Tim Werke, and I represent the highway members and our legislative issues here for the Associated General Contractors. Mr. Chair, if it's all right with the committee, I'd just like to spend a few minutes giving you a little overview of where our organization has engaged on the shutdown, the claims process, what our involvement was going back to the end of session last year up to the shutdown and on to where we are today. And I think we'd probably spend more productive time hearing from Ms. O'Malley in terms of what her impact on her business has been. So if that's fair, I'd like to just proceed and give you a sort of a quick overview. I do have a handout for the committee, and it's really just a record, and I will put it over at the desk. It's a record of our actions in terms of noticing the department and other relevant individuals about what our expectations were for handling the potential government shutdown and then handling claims with regard to contracts and what we anticipated our members' contract rights were. I want to start off, though, first by saying this is, as you can tell by listening to the department, this is a very involved, a very complicated process. I think you heard Mr. Chiglow say there's close to, or if not in excess of, 100 projects, and they can have multiple claims processed in multiple ways. And I think one of the main points I would like to leave you with is the fact that, as Mr. Chiglow indicated, it may be months before we have an idea of what the actual cost is of the shutdown claims. I did want to say we feel it's unfortunate that the report from MMB that was released about 2 months ago did not do an adequate job of indicating that there were additional costs to the state relative to these claims. We feel it left an impression with the public and perhaps with you all that the outcomes were the outcomes in that report and that there would be no real cost effect to the state. But I hope by Ms. O'Malley's testimony you'll see that there is a significant cost to business and construction-related business. A couple of comments in terms of, I think you're all pretty aware of what the construction economy is like in this state, and we have been in a real difficult position with respect to the construction economy. But significant to this situation is that the shutdown occurred during the 20 most productive days of Minnesota's climate-shortened construction season. It could not have happened at a worse time, whether it be economically or construction schedule-wise, for highway transportation construction in the state. A couple of those impacts, contractors could not secure other public work because we were so late in the season that in order to bid other public work and to proceed with those projects, it was just an impracticality on the calendar. Critical construction and supportive services were displaced once the shutdown began, and many of those services did not return to the marketplace. For example, trucking or skilled labor, we found that a lot of those components went to other markets, went to North Dakota or other places where they could be more productive, and it was difficult once we reengaged to get those services back. The inability to resolve all the claims in a real timely manner has had a significant impact on contractors' financing and the ability to carry those costs. We were clear with the department when we met earlier on, which I will cover in my remarks, that we felt that if we could not resolve these claims quickly, that as they played out, you would see that those with the least ability to carry costs that were subject to claim, those folks would be the ones that were hurt probably the most severely. A couple of things with regard to our actions. In mid-June, seeing the potential of a shutdown on the horizon, we filed an amicus brief with the court to have construction determined by the court to be a critical state function. We were not successful in that endeavor. And as a follow-up to that, after the shutdown in early mid-July, we followed up in a hearing with the special master, the court-appointed master, to make a second appeal, I think, along with the chairman and Representative Beard from the House, so that we could impress upon the court and the state to have construction and construction services be deemed a critical core function of the state. And again, we were not successful. Subsequent to that, and you'll see from one of those letters, that on July 19th, at our request, we engaged in a executive-level meeting with MnDOT and their executive staff to talk about reengaging the process, knowing that the shutdown was going to end and that two things needed to occur quickly. Number one was to have projects restarted and how we were going to approach the restart. And then number two was how were we going to get our arms around these construction claims and resolve those claims quickly and fairly. And one of the things, I just want to quickly go through a couple of things that we pointed out to the department that were our concerns that I think are still concerns that are on the table that may be in the middle of trying to resolve some of these claims, and I don't want to go into in detail, but let me cite the State False Claims Act for a second. There's concern that in filing these claims, a contractor is required under the False Claims Act to certify that, to the best of their knowledge, the claim is accurate and reliable. The problematic aspect of that is when a prime contractor has 3, 6, 9 or more subs, and to process their claim, they have to certify that their subcontractor's claims are adequate or are accurate and reliable. And without access to those subcontractors' financial data and how those subcontractors develop their claims, that prime contractor is the one that is at risk in terms of the State False Claims Act. So we've expressed that to the department. We're very concerned about that. Our members have asked about, are they able to file a qualified claim or something short of a qualified claim where they would say, I certify that my portion of the claim is accurate and true, but I cannot be able to certify that these subcontractor elements are accurate and true. So that's an outstanding claim or an outstanding concern.
Mr. Werke, just to go back to Mr. Chigalow's discussion with us on that, it sounded to me like there were multiple claims on multiple projects. It sounded like that was covered under the or they were separate, if you will. Separate claims in this process. So that isn't the case. You're saying that they were all lumped together under the general contractor? And
Mr. Chairman, committee members,
just need some clarity on that.
I'm not sure I'm following your question, but let me try to be a little more clear. There can be multiple claims on each project, but my understanding would be that for each claim that's filed, a certification would have to be signed and delivered with the claim, and you have to certify, the prime contractor needs to certify the accuracy of all of their subcontractors down the chain. And the concern for our members is that they're the prime contractors, and if you had a third or fourth tier sub that's part of the claim string, you don't have access to how they assembled their financials, what they used for records, et cetera, and that could be of a concern and problematic. So I'm not sure that answered your question, Mr. Chair, but I'll continue. And
we're having a bit of a discussion here. Okay. Go proceed, Mr. Werke.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
Just briefly, the other issue that we had of concern is data practices elements of the submittal of your claim in terms of sensitive financial data from private business enterprise. And it's almost a catch-22 in that certainly the state and the department need to know and be able to verify that the information that they're receiving can be justified and can be shown on a financial statement. However, as part of this process, the concern would be that maybe certain elements of that data could be compromised under various provisions of the State Data Practices Act, and our members are very concerned about proprietary financial data being available to their competitors or others and being compromised in that process. So we've had some difficult discussions with the department as to how we can assure that the department can stay right of the data practices law and get the objective data that they need and still protect that financial propriety of the contractor. And I think we're making some progress on those elements, but that was and has been a concern. I think following, again, back, this was July 19th when we discussed these concerns, and we did indicate collectively, both the department and contractors, that it was in both of our collective interests to resolve these claims quickly, accurately, fairly, expeditiously. And we felt confident as an organization that the department would be able to partner with us and we could slog through these claims. It has been somewhat frustrating it has taken this long. Again, our concern was that those least able to manage the cash flow shortage would be hurt the hardest. And in the department's credit, on November 7th, we had an all-day meeting where we spent considerable time, again, as an open forum, talking about claims. We provided those same concerns, et cetera. Just as recently as December 9th, we had another meeting with the MnDOT executive management team talking about these various concerns and elements, the different approaches that could be deployed, how we could move through these claims. I think my message is that we're frustrated as an organization that it's taken this long. It obviously has impacted the construction industry in the state in terms of job loss, in terms of business default, other items. I guess I would question if I would take one issue with the department, why they did not assign someone at an executive level to be solely in charge of managing claims and working through these things. It seems to be more of a collection of various opinions, various activities at different levels within the agency. And if there's something I would have been able to suggest that could be improved is that if there was someone that was made solely in charge of that element. So that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chair, in the interest of time. And I do have with me Lori O'Malley from O'Malley Construction, and she'd like to speak to you about her own business experience.
Thank you, Mr. Werke. Ms. O'Malley, welcome to the committee if you'd identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators, and I want to thank the AGC for the opportunity to speak today. I'm Lori O'Malley, President of O'Malley Construction. We were formed in 2001, so we're only about 10 years into our business, and we are certified as a small business enterprise, disadvantaged business enterprise, targeted group business with the Minnesota Department of Administration, and we're a woman-owned business enterprise. We specialize in concrete highway heavy, which are the curb and gutters, median walk, and driveways. We staff with two crews, under 30 employees through these 10 years, and in those 30 employees, four out of our five adult children have worked for us. We have a seven-month seasonal business. 95% of our work we perform as a subcontractor to the generals. 80 to 90% of our work is either state or state aid projects, including also federal funded projects and ARRA projects. These are large-scale, multi-year contracts. Many of them are design builds, such as the TH-212 from Chaska to Eden Prairie. We came into the 2011 season targeting about $8 million for revenue for our company, and we had over $6 million already on the books by June. Most of those bookings ended up impacted by the state shutdown. There are projects such as the TH-169-494 interchange, the TH-610 design build, TH-14 down in Waseca County, TH-60 in Worthington, and the Elk Run project down in Pine Island. Very large projects. Luckily, we were also contracted on the Civil East portion of the light rail project with Walsh Construction, and that was able to continue through the shutdown. But after the shutdown, not only did the 20-some days of the shutdown impact a dry-up of work, but when the project engineers came back and met with the general contractors to determine what work could still be performed in the season that was left, decisions were made that impacted us to the point of 45% of our bookings were moved into the 2012 season. That put us at such a lack of work that we began desperately bidding against all the other contractors who were in the same position to try to get enough work to keep our business operating. We were bidding at desperately low prices, taking very small installations, which caused us to incur multiple mobilizations, reducing our hours. And as a result of those reduced hours, we lost 5 crew members. That's 23% of our staff, or of our workforce. Those who did stay, they suffered somewhere between $6,000 and $7,000 less of annual wages. And in turn, they had less union benefits paid to their funds, and some of them were faced with insufficient hours to keep their union benefits active without paying an out-of-pocket expense for the continuation. Some of them depleted their unemployment insurance benefits from last year and now face reduction in unemployment insurance benefits to the tune of about $100 a week for this season because of the look-back period to those reduced wages. Needless to say, that risk, we are at risk now of losing others from the seasonal shutdown as spring recruiting may entice them to other contractors who don't engage in primarily state work as we have chosen to do. But the biggest impact to our company has come from the unabsorbed and extended home office overhead costs that were not yet covered from our state shutdown claims that are pending. We only accomplished $4 million of revenue of the $8 million that we had. That's half of our target. So half of our home office overhead costs were still applicable but uncovered by revenue. And with only a seven-month season, when you consider that a seven-month season is 140 working days, that equates to 70 days that are affected. As a small business, our overhead rate is about $5,500 a day, working days, for overhead. 70 days of that equates to about $385,000 worth of costs that we had no revenue to offset that directly impacts our profit and loss. That negative profit and loss showing in our books at the end of this year puts us at risk of losing all of our bonding capabilities for this 2012 season, a potential loss of our operating line of credit and denial of renewal for that, which would then cause us to forfeit the contracts that we had intended to do last year. We wouldn't even be able to perform them this year, not to mention having to negate any legal aspects that those general contractors may come after us for if we forfeit. And again, we may face liquidation of our company in order to pay these debts. I think it's important to understand what is it in a home office overhead that equates to about $5,500 a working day in expenses, just so that people understand that these are legitimate expenses. When you consider, as a small business, you go out and buy about $500,000 worth of equipment on an equipment loan, and you're paying interest on that. And these vehicles all need insurance, they need licenses, they need tires, they need to be DOT'd, they need a mechanic to make sure they're safe, and you need to keep the fuel tanks full. All these expenses, along with 20 cell phones for keeping your employees communicating, you've got monthly leases on shops and offices, you've got salaried positions. These things have been talked about previously today, so I won't elaborate. But on top of all of those fixed expenses in a year, then add close to $1 million worth of an operating line of credit that you use in order to float the company's financials until you can collect your receivables and pay interest on top of all of that. Needless to say, our home office overhead rate has gone up excessively for next year. So our 2012 season right now is in a complete state of uncertainty, and we are unsure of our ability to continue operations. We have bookings of $7 million on the books, but $4 million of that is carryover, and that consumes the capacity for us to bid $4 million worth of new revenue to help us offset what happened to us last year. This doesn't go away for us in 1 year. And we've submitted our claims three times since August. Our position as a subcontractor complicates this, and we have to vary our claims by what our general contractors prescribe. But at this point in our company, we are now planning not only a planning for contingency for operating, but we're also planning an exit strategy, and we face that much uncertainty. Our exit strategy, I want to remind everyone, it affects our family to the tune of 4 of our 5 adult children being without work, without the future that they had planned for as children of business owners, and the potential for the 9 grandchildren that we're planning to carry on. We do have 1 projects. Like I said, we've got $7 million in revenue, and of those 1 projects, I'm not signing the subcontract agreements until I know my future. We are bidding projects. We're being asked to bid every day, but I'm sending out those bids with a contingency that I will sign the subcontract agreement if I could get some state shutdown claim restitution. With that, I just want to stress, you know, what this impact has been to us. I also know that our suppliers have suffered. We had suppliers show up and indicate that they thought they'd lost half of their business, half of our business, to a competitor. Those suppliers aren't coming after the state shutdown claims process. What they're going to do is they're passing on those costs of the same types of financial impact that they had through higher prices. And we're seeing those higher prices as we're getting supplier pricing. I'm hoping that I've made it clear that this impact is far-reaching and very devastating, especially for us in small business. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your testimony, and very eye-opening to us. I hadn't heard about your particular situation. We have heard of others, and just one quick question, though. Are you having trouble with the putting your claim through the prime contractor and their willingness to sign off on it under this False Statement Claims Act? Is that what part of the issue there?
Chairman, that's not really a very large issue. They do have concerns, just like Tim indicated with that. Our generals have been very supportive. Most of the delay seems to be in an uncertainty about the prescriptions of how the calculations are done, how my claim gets rolled up into theirs, the impacts, and the various different rules that seem to be coming out of the advisories committees and those that are making decisions about how this should happen. The process is migrating constantly.
Interesting. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman, one parting comment to tie Ms. O'Malley's situation into another situation that you all have dealt with on this committee. She's a woman-owned, disadvantaged business enterprise certified contractor, and as such, she is one of very few struggling DBEs in this state, and we, as general contractors, have struggled with this issue of meeting our DBE goals on projects. Should her business falter and others in a similar situation, there it leaves very, very few DBE firms from which generals can meet their DBE goals in the future, and it compounds that issue as well. So I just thought that the committee should be aware of how those two things fit together.
Well, the purpose of this hearing was to hear all of the impacts, and we appreciate you bringing that aspect of it up, too. The DBE program and its implementation has been long a part of the discussion that we've had with MnDOT, and that will continue. But keep us informed. You know, we see you quite often, Mr. Werke, and appreciate your input. And as we go forward here in these in this claims process, we'll continue to work with you. The subcontractors bring your concerns to the department and see what we can do to move these forward. Wish you good luck, and hopefully you will be around for the 2012 construction season. So the times look tough sometimes. You know, I'm in the housing business, and you work through those issues sometime. Hopefully the resolution will come out in your favor, and we'll see you out there on the job sites.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Next up is DPS to talk about the MNLAR system.
Good
Ms. Ellison and Ms. McCormick. Nice to see you again. Welcome to the committee. And start off a new session. We'll probably see you here a couple of times, but appreciate your willingness to come and give us an update on how the Minlar system is going and how we're proceeding in that respect.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. And we would like to start the report or our updated report on where we are with Minlars. As you all know, Minlars is the Minnesota Licensing and Registration System, and it's a project of the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services in the Department of Public Safety. And when it's completed, Minlars will provide an efficient, secure system for DVS transactions. The system will replace the core functionality of the following DVS operations: our driver's licensing processes, title and registration, driver compliance, dealer licensing and regulation, inventory, and finance and records. In looking at our annual review, the state revenue collected, these are based on 2010 statistics. The state revenue collected by DVS was $950 million. At this point in time, unofficially, we are reviewing our collections for fiscal year 2011, and right now that's estimated to be $975 million. Vehicle titles issued, 1.3 million. That number stays fairly consistent from year to year. Vehicle registrations issued, 4.6 million. Driver license and identification cards issued, 1.6 million. Customer contacts, over 1.1 million per year. Web user transactions, approximately 375,000. The existing system interfaces with business partners and state agencies, 63, and regular interaction with citizens, law enforcement, courts, the state and federal agencies. We often say to our staff that our staff are really the face of Minnesota because we come in contact with most Minnesota families on a yearly basis. Just to provide a little background, in March of 2007, the Office of Enterprise Technology conducted a systems readiness analysis of our DVS system, and the findings included that our business processes and systems were significantly higher, are significant and highly visible government activities. The platforms, database, applications, and access controls were not considered to be sound. DVS should limit investments in current technologies to critical needs, and that DVS needs to redesign its set of processes and systems, fixing the current system, because it wouldn't be a long-term strategy for us to do that. If DVS systems fail, it would affect data security. Non-public data would be at risk. It would impact data access, which would make it inconsistent and unreliable. Transaction information could lead to inefficient transfer of data and possible loss of data. State and federal mandates would not be able to be implemented without jeopardizing overall system integrity. And there would be limited support for law enforcement and other DVS business partners, as well as a potential loss of close to $1 billion in annual state revenue. Minlar's implementation, we believe, will increase data integrity and system security. It will increase fraud prevention, improve accessibility of information for business partners and customers, improve support for law enforcement, our deputy registrars, our DL agents, dealers, and other DVS business partners. It will improve the timeliness of our services and increase customer convenience. The added value that we believe we will obtain with the implementation of MNLARS is simplifying or automated data collection activities, standardization of our business processes, reduced process times through reduced paperwork and paper flow, the potential to expand our customer service options as well as web-based services, improve our document management capabilities, and improve our reporting capabilities. Now to discuss the processes and stages of the project. As you can see, stage one was completed in 2009, and the focus of that was procurement of a functional requirements vendor and beginning of some of the support projects that we'll discuss in a few minutes. The functional requirements vendor was the process reason that we were procuring those services is to be able to itemize and describe all the business processes that we currently have and what we would hope to have. So it was an as-is-to-be document that was created once we were able to obtain the services for that for the functional requirements vendor. Stage 2A was completed between October 2009 and May 2010, and in that we accomplished an RFI, a request for information, as well as completed the RFP for a system vendor and worked on these support projects that I'll describe in the next slide. Stage 2B, June 2009 to December of 2010, we evaluated and scored the proposals and continued our work on support projects. Stage 2C is ongoing at this time. That started in January of 2011. And we're hoping that we will complete that in the spring of this year. That stage involves vendor negotiations and working on support projects. In the future, stage Norman, three.
Could you just talk a little bit about the support projects? And it seems like an awful long time looks like it'll be about 18 months for vendor negotiations. Could you expound on that a little bit and tell us why that might take so long, and then also what some of the support projects are?
Mr. Chair, we'll move on to this next slide, which I describe a few of the support projects and then can talk a little bit just about the process. Data cleanup, which is an enormous project, and that one identifies all the data stores that we currently have within our system, and we document all data information and capture all business and compliance rules. And the reason that this is so significant is that we want to ensure consistency and accurate data. And one of the things that we've learned in discussions with other states is that it's very important to start this project with good data that's cleaned up, that's accurate. And oftentimes, as you know, in any type of entry within a system, errors can be made that may not be noticeable at the time. But those errors, just even a character, can prevent a transaction from occurring because it's not what's programmed into the system. So we have been spending an enormous amount of time on that. It's an ongoing project, but that is very important, and everyone that we know that works in driver and vehicle systems says that this is a key to a successful implementation of a new system. The second support project is operations improvements, and this is in process as well. And this includes a new ticketing and problem management system. This involves the services that we need, the technical services that we need in order to do our job. So if for some reason or another one of our systems isn't working, there's a problem with the file, we have a quick way that we can notify our technical staff, get the problem fixed, and we want it to be an automated system. And so this has been something that we've been working on, as well as a system whereby we can do some of these activities ourselves. Our staff are trained to get what they need to do and then make the change on their computer themselves or make the change in the data so that we can continue to do our work. A knowledge management system for operations. This is for all technical staff that work on our system. And this is a system that provides the knowledge they need to do their job on the technical side. And also developing an electronic forms library. This is so that we have the forms electronic that we can quickly notify what we call our e-support staff so that they can provide us with the assistance that we need. And we're documenting what the problem was as well as what the resolution is so that we can better standardize our processes and make sure that our staff are available and our technical staff are available to really resolve issues. And then the e-learning is establishing standards and templates. Right now we started with e-learning with our technical staff, but it's going to be very important as we move forward with our business staff as well as with our business partners that we utilize e-learning because we have staff and business partners located throughout the state. So we have developed it on the operational level, but our plan is to expand that so that it'll be able to be done on the business side as well. In terms of just in general the timeline, I think, Mr. Chair, you wanted us to talk about the fact that the project is taking time. I think that, as you know, it was very important for us to document all of our procedures, to also vet that with our business partners at the time. So when we started out with our as-is-to-be documents, that was including business partners and staff in the creation of those as-is-to-be documents. And then we had to go out for a vendor that would help document, make sure that was totally complete. So we had a vendor that did that in preparation for the writing of our RFP for our system vendor. And in that case, that was a 1,000-page document that we put together, our RFP, which took a great deal of time because we're talking not only about complex business processes but a complex system. And also having to ensure that the system that we create is a flexible system and is able to be able to respond to any mandates that are required at either the state or the federal level. And so for those reasons...
Excuse me, Ms. McCormick. Was one of the vendors that helped with these early stage discussions and putting this to all together, is that also one of the vendors that could potentially play a part or build a system? Responding to this RFP?
Mr. Chair, no, this vendor was a vendor that specifically works on business processes and the documentation of that. That was not the vendor that was interested in bidding on the RFP for the system. And so as a result, this complex 1,000-page document required much evaluation once we received the responses that we did from the vendors that applied and did take quite some time to evaluate, and then we had to start negotiation processes.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mary Ellis, and I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. You note that Stage 2C is a long time, and that's true. what we learned in the preparation for the request for proposal process in documenting the businesses and more most importantly in visiting other states who have implemented a new driver and vehicle system is that the vendor negotiation process is extremely important. And it's extremely important to be very, very clear on the statement of work. And so we are spending a large amount of time on that effort, but we feel that over the long term, it's the wisest way to proceed for the state and for the total costs that will be part of this project. It just demands this level of time and effort.
We've seen some of the reports from other states of the issues that they've had trying to implement this type of a system, and I appreciate your approach. It does, when you sit here and look at it, though, it does seem to be getting quite protracted, and of course, we all want to see things move more quickly, I guess, but Senator DeGraff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, as I'm looking at your schedule, I'm trying to determine on here, one of the questions that I get asked the most often by my constituents is when are we going to be at the point where we can receive a title back for a car in 30 days or less? And I'm looking for that in here, and I don't see anything mentioned in here, and I'm wondering if you might elaborate on that.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and certainly, Senator. Obviously, our title turnaround is one of our biggest challenges in DVS right now. The title turnaround is over 90 days, and it's certainly something that we have been working diligently to try to resolve. I don't think we will see a solution where we're reducing our title turnaround to what used to be our goal of a 14-day turnaround until we have the implementation of MNLARS, but we are addressing it. We are addressing the certain things that have come into play this year. We've had a large number of staff who have retired. We have 9 vacancies that we are now just filling, and we are ramping up the training that we're doing for those vacancies. But our title and registration process is extremely complex. It's the calculation of registration taxes, the documents that need to be checked, the verification with the National Motor Vehicle Title Information System. All those things come into play when we're issuing a title. And so we are looking at, we have hired a production specialist who is looking at the entire title production process and looking for ways that we can find efficiencies and create efficiencies. So we are doing that. We have started working on a change in our hiring process, working with our human resources division to see if we can more quickly hire behind people once they retire. So we are doing those things to try to address the problem and try to create as many efficiencies as possible. We have utilized the lean process, which works at streamlining business. We have used that with our expedited title process, and that has made some significant changes. But we are working hand-in-hand with this production specialist to also use the lean process and try to see where we can create efficiencies until we have MNLARS implementation.
Thank you.
And okay, so I'm sorry, and then stage 3, the future, we believe that we will be able to wrap up negotiations sometime this spring, and we are hopeful that we can complete the design, build, and implementation of MNLARS by 2016, and that we would transition support to state staff in that process. In other words, state staff for the operation of the system. And then certainly stage 4 is the future, which includes just the operation, not just, but the operation and support of the system. As I stated, we talked about the support projects, And then just an update on the funding. As you know, the $1.75 surcharge is currently charged on most motor vehicle and driver license transactions, and that continues through June 30th of this year. The surcharge then will be reduced to a dollar on July 1st and extended through June 30th of 2016. And effective in July of this year, or this past year, the $1.50 filing fee increase on motor vehicle transactions that are processed by DVS will go to the DVS technology account. The deputy registrars, of course, keep their own filing fee for those transactions that they process. In fiscal year 2013, there will be a one-time transfer of $7.1 million from the DVS special revenue accounts to the DVS technology account. Certainly, I'm open for any questions you may have.
I think we've lost a significant number of our members here today, so that, there's a lot going on this week, but any other questions? Well, thank you for the update, and again, we appreciate the work that you're doing on this. When we have constituents wondering about these issues of titles and other issues with DMV, it's good to have the information, but it'd be good to see this put into place and reduce some of those times that they're having to wait for these titles. It's causing quite a few problems out there, so one of the more common problems that I hear about.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. One thing I do want to say is that we are looking at starting to do a business walkthrough with our own staff and with the deputy registrars, DL agents, and dealers in later in February and maybe early March, just to get their input in terms of some future business processes that we may be doing with the implementation of MNLAR. So we think it's important, and as Commissioner Ellison said, we've learned from other states that it's important that you get your staff and business partners involved and get their input while you're working on the design and build of the system.
Well, thank you again, and appreciate your being here.
Thank you.
With that, that's all that's on our agenda for today. We'll adjourn the committee.
They've got it.